This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, February 4th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. For most white-collar American workers, the office is a little like a home away from home. Love it or hate it, most of us spend most of our waking hours in an office, and the joys and annoyances of office life have inspired works of art from Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener to NBC's The Office.
Damn it! Damn!
Okay, hold on. Judge is in session. What is the problem here?
You put my stuff in Jell-O again! That's real professional. Thanks. This is the third time, and it wasn't funny the first time.
But last spring, COVID-19 fundamentally changed the way many of us think about office life. In an effort to slow the spread of the pandemic, offices across the country closed, and millions of Americans found themselves working from home. Remote work has benefits for many, but it has also put pressure on workers' relationships, tested their abilities with homeschooling, and upended any work-life balance, not to mention wreaking havoc on their posture and eating habits. Nearly a year later, many companies aren't sure when they will be able to open again safely, what their new offices will look like, and just how many workers they'll be welcoming back. John Seabrook, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the history of office spaces and the economic, political, and demographic ramifications of remote work. Hey, John, welcome to the program. I haven't seen you for quite a long time.
Hey, Dorothy. Yeah, we don't have the office to bump into each other in, right?
And Zoom doesn't quite do it, we've all discovered. Still, it's good to see you. So many of our listeners haven't been to the office since last March. You've been to your desk at The New Yorker exactly once. Tell me about that visit to One World Trade Center.
Yes, well, I was kind of excited. I thought it would be sort of interesting to go back to the office. I have, you know, been in the office when no one was there at night, and I always kind of like that feeling. It's a little spooky, but it sort of feels kind of snug and cozy in a certain way. But I didn't feel anything like that when I went back this time. It just felt really lonely. The silence, which I always sort of wished for while I was in the busy, noisy office working, actually I found very oppressive, and I thought I might get a little work done, but I didn't stick around long. It was just kind of a bummer.
So you've recently written about all of this, and I want to go back and talk a little bit about how modern offices came to look the way they do. I know, as you mentioned, a lot of modern office design can be traced back to the work of an inventor, Robert Probst. And when he developed a concept he called a mind-oriented living space, he was thinking about the needs of what had recently been dubbed knowledge workers. What did these spaces look like?
Yeah, so if you think about the office in the movie The Apartment, which a lot of people
know. I know facts like this because I'd worked for an insurance company, Consolidated Life of New York. We're one of the top five companies in the country. Our home office has 31,259 employees, which is more than the entire population of Natchez, Mississippi. I work on the 19th floor, Ordinary Policy Department, Premium Accounting Division, Section W, desk number 861. My name is C.C.
In that film, the office is one big open room full of desks that are all the same. They all sit in a very regular pattern. And that was a sort of factory floor approach to white-collar work, essentially just imported from, you know, blue-collar factory work and brought into the office. And that was the office for 50 years or so of the 20th century. But in the 60s, this guy named Robert Probst came along and sort of had this fundamental realization that an office that was more conducive to mind-oriented work rather than sort of physical assembly work would produce better work and make people who worked in those offices happier. So that was the sort of fundamental concept behind what he called the mind-oriented office, or some called the action office. And in the action office, instead of that kind of very regular sort of desk-by-desk configuration, you had these kind of interesting movable partitions that were flexible, that allowed you to kind of configure space more to your sort of particular way of working. And it also encouraged more people sort of moving around. His basic notion was that work should be a more active process and not just sort of a sedentary sort of sitting at a desk process. And so he wanted an office that would encourage people to move around, interact, be on their feet more. Standing desks was a big part of that. So that was essentially the sort of utopian notion that Robert Probst brought to the offices in the 60s.
Yet near the end of his life, Probst emphatically disavowed his own invention. And he said, as you quoted him, "The dark side of this is that not all organizations are intelligent and progressive. Lots are run by crass people who can take the same kind of equipment and create hellholes. They make little bitty cubicles and stuff people in them, barren rat hole places." So maybe talk about that a little bit and this never-ending search for the ideal office environment.
Yeah, so, you know, Probst had these wonderful ideas in the 60s, but by the 80s, these kind of utopian notions of the action office had turned into the cubicle farm that I began professional life in. And a lot of people came to sort of feel were barren, soulless places. And so how did that happen? How did this, you know, utopian notion develop into this sort of hellhole of rat holes? And I think what you have to realize in any office plan, you have sort of at least two kind of often opposed points of view. You have the designer who is trying to kind of create the ultimate workspace that will, you know, increase productivity and interactions, innovation. And then you have the office manager who is trying to kind of keep costs down and sort of improve the bottom line. You know, maybe at a flush time, you have the designer gets to sort of render the office in the way he wants it to be. But in a pinch time or in a recessionary time, the office manager comes in and says, you know what, we need to reduce costs. And that's kind of what happened with Probst's, you know, action flexible office, is that because it was flexible, it was easy for office managers to reconfigure it, and so that those walls became cubicle walls and that the footprint sort of shrank, and so that, you know, it eventually became these little bitty sort of, you know, honeycomb cells that those of us that spent time in them know very well. And so at the end of his life, he was very sort of pessimistic about what his ideas had wrought.
But then there was the internet boom of the 90s, and Silicon Valley set out to change all of that, promising a more democratic office design. And I was suddenly remembering this morning that Michael Bloomberg was an early advocate of CEOs losing those corner offices. And he promised in 2019, during his brief run for president, that he'd turn the East Room into an open office plan. He tweeted that he'd be where a leader should be with his team. So my question is, did the new floor plans introduce egalitarianism into the workplace?
Okay, so, you know, Probst didn't really talk about hierarchy. And even, in Probst's utopian notions, there were still, you know, executives with corner offices. It really wasn't until you get to the sort of 70s and the West Coast and the beginnings of what now is the tech industry that you begin to see what is this sort of very egalitarian and really quite revolutionary movement to basically take down the walls and to move all of those perimeter offices with views and doors and walls and sound privacy. That all kind of began to go away, and the modern open office, which is quite different from the sort of Jack Lemmon open office, began to find its way into mainstream work culture, but very much sort of west to east, and also from tech industry to other forms of knowledge work like advertising or, in our case, publishing. The thought was that, well, let's get a little of what they're, you know, getting in our industry, and maybe we can do that by, you know, making an office like they have. So that was sort of the driver there.
And then they became both a subject of envy and ridicule when, as you know, they had this community-based philosophy of team-based work. And OK, so everybody got more light. That was a good thing. But then it was kind of like a playground for, once again, a male majority workforce, you know, with all these amenities, skateboarding and workout rooms, game rooms, and, you know, on and on, napping pods, laundry services. And those were all incentives to keep workers there at all hours. And again, make, in this case, make work more fun.
Right. I think the other big point here is that the work we're talking about in the case of the tech industry is software, building software, and the nature of the work and the kinds of people you're going to need to get the job done isn't clear at the outset. You know, the problems that you're going to face, you're building things that haven't existed before. You don't really know what the work is going to be. And so having a team and having the ability to add to that team as new problems arise was essential. And that was really the driver for this sort of team-based, you know, sort of open office kind of, you know, configuration. But when you start moving into other industries where the work is a little bit more defined and also where people sort of have depended and required on sort of focus and privacy to get their work done, it presents a number of problems for a worker who's trying to concentrate on his own stuff throughout the day. And, you know, there's all these distractions going along and around them, and there's no walls to go and retreat from it in. So that's where it gets difficult.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You recently took a tour of Campari America's headquarters in New York, and you described them as peak office as lifestyle. Maybe tell us what you found there.
So the Campari offices are in the Grace Building overlooking Bryant Park. They used a lot of the ideas of, you know, sort of activity-based design, which is so you had your open office plan, and it was very distracting. And then in the 90s, there was this idea of kind of building these kind of huddle rooms, areas of focus within the open office that would allow for a little less kind of noise. And that was called activity-based design. And so a lot of the big brands, particularly on the East Coast, took this notion of kind of activity-based design and sort of combined it with the idea of branding and created, as the person who toured me around the office said, an office for people who live the brand every day. The reception desk is a branded reception desk with it's a big marble C. It looks like Campari. And all of the rooms are sort of the colors, and the color palettes are designed according to the tasting profiles of different liquors. And then you have all these bars. You know, you have five different actual bars in the office that sort of serve as meeting rooms, but also sort of event rooms. And you have no personal desks, which is a theme that I think is going to continue and maybe now become very widespread, is that you have to actually reserve your desk before you go into the office, because, you know, someone else can use that desk too. There are no personal desks in the Campari America space. And I think that's what we're going to see in a lot of offices as we return. Again, it's just sort of this big move from sort of personal private space to public shared space in the office that I feel like the pandemic has accelerated.
Yeah. So maybe talk about RGA, an advertising and marketing agency, which showed you the results of some surveys it took about worker satisfaction after the forced home relocation. And employees initially responded well to the increased flexibility and to collaborative tools like Zoom.
Yeah. One of the huge sort of revelations of the pandemic is how well working from home works. And in fact, the office, which we thought was for work, turns out actually maybe to be for something else, because the work that we thought we could only do there, we can do at home. And so RGA, which is a big digital advertising firm, conducted a series of surveys with their employees as they were working from home to discover if, you know, their productivity or their feel that company culture was eroding, productivity was lessening. And they found that actually they were getting not just as much work done, but more work done, maybe not for the best reasons. I mean, partly I think it's a lot of people were very anxious about performing well after, you know, everybody went home. And so they probably worked harder. Also, there were fewer things to do and you're home, you know, you don't have that work-life balance. So where does work stop and life begin? It was harder to draw those lines. So yeah, RGA found that remote work was going really well, except for certain people that were struggling with it. So it depends on your family situation, your apartment, what kind of room you have for doing that work in. And I think going forward, you know, this is going to be a big change as human resources is going to really have to work on a very individual person-by-person basis and figuring out how to make, you know, workers happy and not just sort of a policy that's going to apply to workers across the board.
Yet there was also something incredibly appealing to companies as they saw that working from home had these dramatic benefits for the bottom line because their employees were working longer hours. And, you know, if enough of them work from home, CFOs could save a lot of money on office space. But then, you know, are there also incentives that are compelling companies to try to reopen?
Yeah, I mean, the surveys that RGA did, and this kind of squares with what I've heard and what I actually feel, is that most people don't want to go back to the office 5 days a week, but they don't want to not go to the office ever either. They want to go in 1 or 2 days, maybe 3 days a week, but, you know, 1 or 2 would probably be fine. Partly just for that sort of like seeing their friends and socializing, but also for, you know, sort of those group meetings or, you know, sort of free flowing discussions that Zoom tends not to really be that great on. You know, Zoom is good, I think, if you have sort of a focused topic and, you know, you kind of know what you're trying to achieve. But, you know, the kind of water cooler stuff, the sort of serendipity, which is the word you always hear about, you know, what's lacking in remote work, you know, which I think there's something to that for sure. And the other reason for going back is right now we're in an era where basically very few people are back at work. So everyone's working remote. But once some people go back, then you've got a whole new set of conflicts about, you know, who's getting what kind of assignments and, you know, does face-to-face encounters with a boss improve your particular standing more than the remote worker's standing? And how is that actually going to play out in the future? That's a real issue.
You know, also thinking more broadly about the effects of all of this, we've seen over the past year this huge exodus from Manhattan and Brooklyn as people who have the means to do so have fled their dense urban living for the suburbs. That depopulation destabilized service industries, which were already hurting. If offices aren't going to be as central to life in New York as they once were, and if restaurants and movie theaters and the like are going to be slow to come back, what are the chances that those who left the city are going to return?
I don't see them coming back. I mean, you know, if you're living in a place that's cheaper and, you know, the charms of New York aren't there, which, you know, the restaurants and the theaters, why would you come back to your smaller apartment and, you know, all of the sort of inconveniences of city life when you've been enjoying yourself outside of the city? I do think, generally speaking, the idea of having a headquarters, you know, that everybody has to come into, rather than having a series of satellite offices that are closer to where people live, I just feel like the latter is going to continue to gain currency. And, you know, the notion that everybody has to be in one place in the sort of center of the world, you know, is going to lose currency. You know, what it comes down to is, what are the young, talented people going to want? Offices will adapt to recruit the most talented people. And if working from home in a, you know, a nicer location is what young, desirable recruits want, then companies will provide that for them.
In Robert Putnam's 2000 bestseller, Bowling Alone, he really popularized the idea that communities grow out of personal interactions. And so I was thinking about this as I was listening to you. In a job setting, social capital is accumulated by working in the presence of others. And it's really, we've all experienced how that's depleted during virtual interactions. What are you thinking about as you look forward to returning to the office?
Well, you know, I feel like I'm a model for the future office worker because I've been kind of working this way for my whole career. I mean, at the New Yorker, we are blessed, or at least we have been, the New Yorker writers, with having offices. And I've always cherished the ability to both be able to stay home and, you know, do my writing, which I basically do at home, but then to be able to come in once the writing is done and to interact with my editor and with other editors and with you and the fact checkers. And they're two very different sides of what I consider to be my sort of work experience. And I really miss that. I didn't even know how much I relied on that kind of once a week, maybe, interaction with, or even once every other week interaction with my, you know, colleagues. But I'm really looking forward to getting back into the office. I mean, it's not just about work. I think we all realize how much more the office is than work. Even if it's just a question of dividing up your day. And also, if you're a parent, we haven't really talked about that, but I have a 12-year-old daughter who's right above me now in school. And that has been continually challenging. It's sort of like sometimes feels like you're kind of trying to get work done in the school classroom. And who gets prioritized in that situation, your work or your child's education? It's a horrible decision to even have to make. And so you all, and I think a lot of parents feel very guilty about kind of, you know, sticking the iPad in their kids' hands and letting them go at it so that they can get some work done. But, you know, what are your options?
And also, I should say, for younger office workers, I would think that so many of them yearn to go back because so much of their social life turns on their experience during the day and then after work with their colleagues.
And also, how do you really learn about a company and a culture if you're a newbie without being in the physical presence of other older, experienced workers? How would I have learned, you know, to do what I do without actually being able to sort of come into the office, see older writers, you know, talk to older editors, even beyond work, you know, the just sort of all the culture that goes along with a company. The New Yorkers kind of got this wonderful culture of sort of politeness and respect for each other that would be really hard to take in if you weren't actually there and being able to see how other people treat each other. For people coming in, you know, right out of college, I just feel like it's really important for them to be able to have a physical place to go to and learn, you know, what it's like to work for that company.
Well, absolutely. And I look forward to seeing you in person and our other colleagues of all ages as soon as is humanly possible.
Me too.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
John Seabrook, a New Yorker staff writer, is the author of four books, including most recently The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.